There it is. All right. I'm going to see probably.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to.
Okay.
Work it out with all the background noise. We're going to take that off later.
Okay.
All right.
So we're doing it on a phone?
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't bring any fancy
sure.
equipment or anything.
Good work.
Herzlich willkommen bei Meditation Coaching and Life. Mein Name ist Michael Kurt, auch bekannt als Curse, und heute freue ich mich über meinen ganz besonderen Gast, Professor Bob Thurman. Herzlich willkommen hier bei Meditation Coaching and Life noch einmal. Ich hoffe, euch allen geht es sehr, sehr gut. Ich habe in diesem Podcast in den letzten Monaten ja damit angefangen, mich hin und wieder mal mit Leuten zu unterhalten. Ich nenne das auf gar keinen Fall Interviews, denn ich bin weder Journalist noch irgendwie professionell vorbereitet. Ich liebe es einfach, mich zu unterhalten mit Menschen, die inspirierend sind. Und mein heutiger Gast ist eine riesige Inspiration für mich, aber auch für ganz viele andere Menschen. Es handelt sich um Professor Robert Thurman, kurz Bob Thurman oder noch kürzer Tenzin. Und Tenzin ist sein tibetisch-buddhistischer Name und so nennen ihn ganz liebevoll seine Schülerinnen und Schüler auch seine Frau und einer seiner besten Kumpels, der Dalai Lama. Bob Thurman hat einen ganz krassen Lebensweg hingelegt, über den ich euch ein kleines bisschen was erzählen möchte, bevor wir in das Interview gehen. Das Gespräch ist auf Englisch. Und falls ihr das Transkript oder eine deutsche Übersetzung sucht, dann schaut hier in die Shownotes, im Podcast oder bei YouTube. Und da werdet ihr dann hoffentlich auch fündig werden. Bob Thurman ist 1941 geboren in den USA und hat schon als Teenager angefangen, sich mit Spiritualität, Meditation und so weiter zu beschäftigen. Das war damals in den 50ern in den USA. Da war das noch überhaupt kein Thema. Da war der Dalai Lama noch nie in den USA. Da war das wirklich noch absolut in den Kinderschuhen. Und er hat dann, ich glaube, als 19- oder 20-Jähriger rausgefunden, dass irgendwo bei ihm in der Nähe ein tibetischer Lama wohnt. Ein mongolisch-tibetischer Lama ist dahin und hat sich da beworben quasi. Und hat dann neben seinem Studium, was er zu der Zeit gemacht hat, und seiner ersten Ehe und seinem ersten Kind als ganz junger Typ, angefangen dort für diesen mongolisch-tibetischen Lama zu arbeiten als Organisator der Bibliothek quasi. Er bezieht sich auch nochmal auf seinen alten mongolischen Lama. Er nennt den im Interview, ich sag schon wieder Interview, im Gespräch, nennt er ihn My Old Mongolian. Und der hat ihm also so die ersten Einführungen in den Buddhismus gegeben. Und da er die Bibliothek organisieren musste, hat Bob dann angefangen, Tibetisch zu lernen und Sanskrit und Pali, die ganzen alten Sprachen, in denen die buddhistischen Schriften verfasst sind. Irgendwann nach ein paar Jahren, ich glaube nach 3 oder 4 Jahren mit abgeschlossenem Studium, hat er gesagt, ich gehe nach Indien und ich werde Mönch. Und sein Lama hat die Hände über dem Kopf zusammengeschlagen, konnte ihn aber nicht aufhalten. Und Bob hat seine Sachen gepackt. Und ist losgezogen. Erst über die Türkei und den Iran und hat dort mit Schamanen und Sufi-Meistern, also Sufi ist der mystische Islam, gelernt. Also nach seinen eigenen Aussagen hat er irgendwie ganz lange in der Wüste gesessen und meditiert und in die Sonne gestarrt. Hat er gesagt, das war keine so richtig gute Idee. Und ist dann weiter nach Indien gereist. In Indien hat er angefangen, tibetischen Buddhismus zu studieren. Und hat den Dalai Lama kennengelernt. Der Dalai Lama ist ein paar Jahre älter als Bob, aber nicht viel älter. Und die beiden haben sich angefreundet. Bob Thurman wurde dann der erste Amerikaner, der vom Dalai Lama als Mönch ordiniert wurde. Also er war nicht der erste westliche Mönch oder sowas, aber der war der erste Westler, der vom Dalai Lama selbst als Mönch ordiniert wurde. Er hat also 4 Jahre direkt mit dem Dalai Lama studiert in Indien als Mönch. Und ist dann irgendwann wieder zurückgegangen nach USA, wie er sagt, auch hier im Gespräch, weil sein Karma war, seine Frau kennenzulernen. Mit dieser Frau ist er bis heute zusammen. Sie heißt Nenna. Sie ist ganz, ganz wundervoll. Sie ist Ex-Model und Psychoanalytikerin, hat auch deutsche Wurzeln, worüber Bob auch ein bisschen erzählt in dem Podcast. Er verwendet auch manchmal deutsche Worte hier, wie zum Beispiel Freiheit und andere Dinge. Und Zusammen mit seiner Frau Nenna hat Bob dann 4 Kinder bekommen, die alle ganz viele krasse Sachen machen. Zum Beispiel seine Tochter Uma. Und wenn man den Vornamen Uma und den Nachnamen Thurman zusammentut, dann landet man bei Uma Thurman. Und ja, seine Tochter ist die Schauspielerin aus Pulp Fiction und den ganzen anderen Filmen. Seine anderen Kinder machen aber auch ganz großartige Sachen. Zum Beispiel leitet einer seiner Söhne das Tibet House US. Das ist der kulturelle Center des Dalai Lama in Amerika. Da könnt ihr in den Shownotes zu diesem Podcast auch die ganzen Links finden. Und da gibt es ganz viele interessante Veranstaltungen, die auch online stattfinden. Und ganz viel Hintergrundmaterial, wenn ihr euch weiter für tibetischen Buddhismus interessiert. Das gleiche gilt auch für Menla. Menla ist ein Retreat-Zentrum in den USA, wo Bob ganz viele Kurse gibt. Geleitet wird das Zentrum von seiner Frau Nenna. Auch da seht ihr den Link in den Shownotes. Da könnt ihr gucken, da gibt es ganz viele Online-Kurse, die man live mit Bob Thurman und mit ganz vielen anderen tollen Lehrerinnen und Lehrern auch machen kann, wenn ihr ein bisschen das, was ihr hier hört, oder überhaupt Meditation und Buddhismus weiter vertiefen möchtet. Bob hat also nicht nur geheiratet und 4 Kinder bekommen, sondern hat seine Studien und seine Lehrtätigkeit als buddhistischer Lehrer fortgesetzt. Er hat über 13 Bücher selber geschrieben und hat ganz viele buddhistische Texte aus den alten Sprachen übersetzt. Er ist also maßgeblich daran beteiligt, dass viele buddhistische alte Texte überhaupt auf Englisch oder überhaupt in westlichen Sprachen verfügbar sind. Und unter diesen 13 Büchern, die er geschrieben hat, ist unter anderem auch ein Buch über die Bardo-Zustände. Das sind die Zustände, die Übergangszustände im tibetischen Buddhismus, zum Beispiel der Wachzustand, der Traumzustand, der Schlafzustand und der Zustand des Todes. Und das, was man so allgemein hin als das tibetische Totenbuch bezeichnet, ist eigentlich eine falsche Übersetzung. Und eigentlich ist es die Lehre von den Dazwischenzuständen. Und Bob hat davon eine ganz großartige Übersetzung gemacht. Und das gibt es auch als Audiobuch, wie auch viele andere seiner Bücher, zum Beispiel The Jewel Tree of Tibet und ganz viele andere. Und dieses Buch über das Bardo und über die Bardos und über das Sterben und die Wiedergeburt im tibetischen Buddhismus, das hat mich an einem ganz besonderen Moment erwischt, als ein ganz, ganz, ganz lieber Freund von mir gestorben ist. Und ich mich ganz intensiv mit dem Tod und mit dem, was da vielleicht passieren kann oder was nicht passiert und auch der Wiedergeburt im tibetischen Buddhismus auseinandergesetzt habe. Und da war dieses Audiobuch, das sind quasi Vorträge von Bob Thurman zu diesem Thema, für mich ein ganz, ganz großer Anker und ein ganz großer Leuchtturm. Und was an Bob Thurman so faszinierend ist, und das werdet ihr auch noch hören, der Mann hat ein unglaubliches Wissen über Buddhismus, über Meditation, aber auch über ganz viele andere spirituelle Traditionen. Er war Professor an der Columbia University, ist bis heute einer der besten Freunde des Dalai Lama, ist ein unglaublich intensiv Praktizierender, also nicht nur jemand, der viel weiß, sondern jemand, der extrem viel selbst praktiziert und jemand, der dieses Wissen unglaublich großzügig weitergibt. Und das Ganze mit unglaublich viel Humor. Bob Thurman zuzuhören und mit Bob Thurman gemeinsam im Raum zu sitzen, das ist wie fast zu einer wahnsinnig intelligenten Stand-up-Comedy-Show zu gehen. Bob macht unglaublich viele Witze und nimmt sich selbst pausenlos aufs Korn und nimmt alle anderen aufs Korn und ist einfach wahnsinnig wortgewandt und charmant und es ist eine Freude, ihm zuzuhören. Ich hatte die große Freude, Bob Anfang diesen Jahres zu treffen auf einem Retreat, was er geleitet hat, zu dem ich extra hingereist bin. Und wir haben eine Woche zusammen verbracht mit 20 Leuten in einem wunderschönen Wald, auf einer wunderschönen Farm nahe des Meeres. Und es war ganz magisch. Und bei diesem Retreat ist das folgende Gespräch entstanden. Ich wünsche euch wahnsinnig viel Spaß mit Bob Thurman und seinen Erklärungen über The Matrix, den Film, wie es weitergeht bei The Matrix oder auch nicht und über die tibetischen buddhistischen Konzepte von Leerheit, also nicht nur tibetisch-buddhistisch, sondern buddhistische Ideen wie Leerheit und Aktivismus und Meditation und wie das zusammengeht und wie nicht und seine persönliche Geschichte. Lasst euch einfach faszinieren und begeistern von dem, was Bob erzählt. Viel Spaß mit diesem Gespräch mit Professor Robert Thurman, a.k.a. Bob Thurman, a.k.a. Tenzin.
Okay.
I see everything is running. Yes, that looks good.
All right.
Perfect.
Okay.
All right, perfect. Thank you very much for doing this.
My pleasure, Mike. It's great to have you here.
I appreciate it. It's so the podcast is called Meditation, Coaching, and Life. So we can talk about anything because the word life is in there. So
life is there.
So anything.
You said meditation, coaching?
Yes.
Okay.
And life. So
Meditation, coaching, and life.
Yes. And I wanted to... That's why I wanted to pick it up where we left off in some conversation we had a couple of days ago.
Okay.
We were talking about The Matrix.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
My favorite movie.
It is your favorite.
Matrix and Avatar.
Ah.
Those are my two favorites lately.
All right. Why? Okay. The thing is, I heard the story about Dzongsa Khyentse Rinpoche.
Yes.
He took his students to see The Matrix.
Yeah,
because
he's
like, you have to watch this film. It's like a parable for...
Okay.
Do you think it's a Buddhist film?
Well, yes, it has that element. But what I particularly like about The Matrix is the fact that people go there, sort of regular people, to see an action film.
Mm.
And they get plenty of action. But then when they get into the concept of The Matrix, they actually have the idea that reality is virtual. And especially my favorite parts of The Matrix, besides the drama, you know, I like Trinity and Keanu and the rabbit hole, the whole thing. I don't like all of that. But once they get in there, it's the training that he gets from Morpheus in the first Matrix in particular. And in that training, because you're identifying with Neo, right? Because he's the hero. And then they're doing martial arts and they're doing things that you can't physically normally do because they're in a world that is only virtual, right? And it's in a way, therefore, it mentally can be moved around in another way. So by identifying with him, they suddenly are, and then at one point, like when he comes out and there is in a blank space, but he's got his little leather jacket and Morpheus is standing there. And then he says to Morpheus, well, if this is just a computer simulation, what is all this? And he looks at his body and his thing. And Morpheus says, it's a digital residual self-image.
Mm.
And I really like that, or something close to that.
Yeah.
And I really like that because it's the idea that you're sort of creating your own reality. You know? And then at one point he gets knocked down during the martial arts and he's sort of out of breath. And Morpheus says, you think that's air you're breathing?
Mm.
And then again, he gets where he holds up, he catches the helicopter and so forth. But then there's the whole thing, he's not the one and blah, blah, blah. And but what I especially like is that training thing because it gives people a subliminal experience of being in a virtual reality, which is a kind of an illusion, and yet treating it as a reality. And then the theme is that once you know it's an illusion and you're aware of what is constructing the illusion, then you can deal with it in a more effective way. Like he just pops those after Trinity kisses him. Of course, love has to get into it. So love gives him the power and he finally wakes up out of being shot down by the agents. And she gives him that kiss of his other body, which is over in the submarine there, wherever it is. And then he gets up and pops out the bullets. And then he totally turns himself into pure light by merging with the Matrix energy. And he merges with the agent, Mr. Smith, and the other two run away. Remember, and so it's a teaching of the illusoriness of reality, and that the hero can actually master that. And then there are a lot of little details that I think the Wachowski sisters, as they are now, they used to be brothers, right? Now they're sisters. That they almost didn't pick up on, because then the most intriguing thing in the later Matrix scenes. The next two were pretty much fighting and, you know, they're more or less getting along with action.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that a couple of instances, he deals with those machines outside of the Matrix in real reality, so-called, as if it was still a Matrix. And he just kind of goes like this and they go crash. And then the third one, he completely sails through a field of the machines and he keeps blasting them. He can't even see them. But he blasts them as if, again, he was the one in the Matrix. Mm. So, you know, I talked to the producer once and I told him that I had a script or I had a treatment for his fourth one. And it would have been great and it's too bad they never made one. And then he said, They were going to make one, and I think it was all the wrong thing, so just as well they did it. But because the fourth matrix, the real challenge then in the matrix is bringing the virtual reality of the matrix together with the so-called actual reality, which was this destroyed planet where they have all these batteries, which are human beings, and the computer is running it, you know. But in a way, the computers are just running it because they're trying to keep life going. And there must be a way of fixing the planet itself, you know. And especially if you get someone who has the training to use the world itself like a matrix, then you can reshape it into a Buddha land. That's what the fourth one should be. Not more fighting, you know. But I don't know. They're not going to make it, probably. But that's why I like it.
Yeah.
I don't know what Kenzei said, but maybe he's sort of a little bit intimating the similar thing. It isn't like it makes a Buddhist point.
Yeah.
And again, you know, the way you say Buddhist movie, this is what I want people to really understand, is that the real thing about Buddhism is it's not a religion and a whole bunch of beliefs opposite to some materialism or something else. It is science itself. And as a science, it does challenge materialism, and it also challenges theism. And it has another kind of vision of the human potential and how a human can become this kind of extraordinary being, which is a Buddha being. So it's a kind of, it has a biological evolutionary theory, that's the karma theory, and it has a physics theory, and the physics theory is relativity. Emptiness, so-called famous emptiness, freedom, voidness, is actually the discovery of relativity, because that's what it means.
Could you elaborate on that, like a little
bit? Everything is empty of any non-relative component. And the absolute is empty of being the absolute. And so the absolute is simply a negation of anything that presents itself as if it were an absolute, which in a way violates the relativity of things. And the relativity of things means that the way you see them in relativity is always somewhat illusory. So they're not absolute realities, but in a way what the absolute reality is this whole relativity. So, but that's a really cool thing, because then there's no escape from this. And therefore, the one thing you can, if this is the absolute, then the only thing you can do is put your total dedication, if you will, your absolute energy into making it better for everybody. Because there's no escape, there's no way out. You don't get to go live in heaven and leave other people in the muck. You know what I mean?
Yes.
You have to bring everybody into something better. Every animal, so not just every human being, every being. So it's a scientific tradition rather than, and therefore it's always gotten along with Hinduism, with Confucianism, and with the Western religions. Eventually it will also get along. And actually even the Dalai Lama considers secular humanism to be another world religion of, you know, that doesn't want to have truck with anything that it can't materially measure, you know. And that's like a religion, and it has a good side, which is investigating everything, and has a bad side, which is making materialism into a dogma, right? And closed-minded thing, and not looking at more subtle things in reality, you know? So that's a little bit about that.
Now, when you're talking about, you know, maybe I'll ask you something about emptiness.
Please,
you know,
please,
it's
please,
probably
sure,
going to
sure.
blow everybody's mind. But another question I had before, a little bit more concrete maybe,
yeah,
that maybe has something to do with emptiness.
Okay, good.
Is the question now, a lot of people want to make the world a better place, right? They want to change the world.
Right.
So they get into social action.
Yes.
They get into, you know, they become very righteous about things and so on and so on.
Right.
But a lot of people like that, they burn out, or they become very angry, or they become very disillusioned or something.
Yes.
So, what is your thought on that? As you're talking about Buddhism, would be a vehicle to, or like,
yes.
would it be
well,
a means
it's an education.
To, yeah.
It's an education. You see, Westerners have not wanted to encounter it as an education, because Westerners think they're smarter than everybody else. And that those Asian people, well, they're kind of cool and they meditate and they look cute and they have their cute Buddha that we can put in the garden, you know, and feel calm because the Buddha's there. But basically, we have nothing to learn from them. Maybe we train, you know, like a dog. We learn to sit still, or we learn to not think, or we learn to think more sharply. But there's nothing to learn from them. And so therefore, they always say Buddhism is a bunch of training, like you train a horse or a dog or something. Because we've had a lot of education in our universities and gymnasiums and in schools, And we're still miserable and we don't know what the hell is going on.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we think education is useless. Mm. But actually, Buddhism is education. It's a different higher education. Adishiksha is the Sanskrit word. It's a higher education where you educate your emotions, you educate your mind, you educate yourself, you discover the physical nature of reality, which is relativity. And emptiness is there's no absolute that reality hides in or you can run away from reality into. The absolute is this relativity. So you have to just hang out and you have to make it better with other people. Now, the thing about the burnout thing, and you mentioned righteousness and so forth, the human being has a tendency to put their ideas ahead of their experience. Mm. You know, like they make dogmas out of their theories and then mm-hmm. they sacrifice even life on top of a theory. Mm-hmm. And that's wrong. Buddhism is like the good side of modern science in that Buddha always said, I think he's so cool, actually. Buddha is really cool. He says he sits up one morning, he really feels happy. He says, wow, I'm so happy. I know everything and I feel great. I really feel great. And I know that you can know it too, but I'm so sorry, I can't really explain it to you.
Because it's quite a bummer.
Words. It's beyond words. Yeah. I can give you a way, though, you can experience it. Mm-hmm. You can practice some methods and you can sharpen your mind and sharpen your attention and sharpen your mindfulness and your insight. And then you have the genius to realize it. In other words, he challenged when I was a little boy, when I was in student in school, I really didn't like. In the church, they tell you, well, you can't understand. You just have to believe what we tell you. Yeah. God understands, but you're not going to ever understand. That's the way you are. You just don't understand. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. So I said, what's the point of that? Why should I believe something for no reason? If I believe something for no reason, I'll believe anything. Mm. Right? So I rejected that. Then you go to the science people and say, oh, yeah, you can analyze this molecule and this thing and that and the other. But of course, the more you discover about it, the more you will know you don't know.
Yeah.
So you'll never understand everything anyway. But hell, go at it. You go at it, some little piece of it and make some money, make a drug or do something, invent something. And I didn't like that either. And what I loved when I encountered the Buddhist educational tradition was they say, not only can you understand yourself and the world, but if you want to be happy, you have to understand it. And actually, it took me a long time to realize what is the foundation of that assurance. And the foundation of it is that the Buddha supposedly is a person who did understand reality fully. And what he understood was reality is freedom from suffering. Reality is bliss and happiness. So the more you know of reality, the happier you will be.
It doesn't appear to be the experience of everyday people though, right?
That's right. But that's because they don't know what it is. Everyday people don't know what is real. They think that they're the realest thing, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm the realest, and everybody else is not real. And then once they think that, since the universe doesn't agree with them, that they're more real than everything else, they suffer because they're fighting something. They're struggling with it, you know? And that was then Buddha's predicament. Once he was so happy, and once he realized that reality is happiness, if you fully merge with it and know what it is, it's happiness. You know, his Four Noble Truths, for example, people have misunderstood. He said, if you don't know reality, if you're unenlightened, you will suffer.
Yeah, which usually it's like life is suffering, right?
That's right. But it's the unenlightened life is suffering. See, it was less pessimistic than Socrates, who said the unexamined life is not worth living. Buddha never said that. Life is very much worth living because we are these intelligent animals that have the ability to understand ourselves, which is like really awesome. You know, crocodile can't really understand. They can eat that thing in front of them, but they're not going to really figure out their cosmic reality. Do you know what I mean, the crocodile? In a way, they're part of cosmic reality, but they can't understand that. So then when the crocodile evolves and the lucky crocodile becomes a human. And then they do understand. And even they understand they were crocodiles at some time. And so they don't really are not too much against crocodile. But they also don't fantasize that it's great to be a crocodile. They realize crocodile has quite a lot of suffering because it's more ignorant than a human. So that was Buddha's thing. And he says, wow, everything's great. And even he saw that everybody else, even crocodiles, are great. But then he realized that when they don't know that, they suffer. And so the first noble truth is that if you're unenlightened, you'll suffer. But that doesn't mean it's not worth doing. It's worth because you can become enlightened. Then the reason for that is that you exaggerate your own sense of reality. Mm-hmm. As my old Mongolian used to say, people are correct when they think they're real, but where they're wrong is where they think they're really real. And then especially, we all think we're more real than the other person, and then the other person disagrees with that, and they think they're more real than us.
So when you say we think we're more real than the other person, you're talking about the feeling that, like me and my experience, is like the ultimate thing that's going on here.
That's right.
But then there's people, right, who say, oh, you know, I'm really not that important. I'm putting everyone else and everybody else is suffering first. And I'm, until, you know, everybody has equal rights and until all that stuff, I'm going to just put myself out there completely, work for that cause.
Yes.
You know, how...
That's really nice of them. But the thing is, if they do it on the basis of like categorical imperative or something, but then secretly, really, still inside, they still think they are the one.
Like saying, I should do that.
Yeah. They're driving themselves in a certain way by an ideology. And they still haven't really had the experience of being open to everyone else and connected to everyone else. And they're not really empathic to everybody else. They don't really feel the other people's suffering. And in a way, because they're suffering and they're putting themselves out, they get a little subliminally, even as humble as they say they may be, they think a little bit better than the other one because they're the one who's helping.
Mm.
And then because the real compassion has to be only based on wisdom, on knowing your own open-heartedness and knowing your connection to the other person. Just like, for example, you put your hand on a hot pot on your stove and you don't say, shall I be nice to my hand today and take it off? You don't say that. You just take it off. And so if you get where you can feel the other person because you're so open, you've opened your heart in a certain way, and then you draw the energy from their need for the help, and then you have this infinite energy of other beings' need. So you're not forcing yourself to do something and then later burning out and feeling, I was a big martyr and it didn't do any good, and there's still so many more people suffering, and oh, God. And, you know, in other words, there's also something called, in Buddhist psychology, there's something called the pride of humility.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so humble, you know, but still you think you're the most important, you know, that's the pride of humility. Mm. You know?
So how do you cure that? Like, how do you cure that condition?
You realize what you are. And when you realize what you are is this super intelligent, super sensitive being that can really discover one's own inner freedom from being absolutely this or that. And then find out that the boundary between oneself and other is more or less by design. It isn't anything absolute either. Then the more you do that, the more open and empathic you become. You know,
Mitgefühl? Compassion or?
Yeah. But you feel Mitfühlen.
Mitgefühl.
Yeah. You get this Mitgefühl and you actually Mitgefühl. You feel with that they feel. Yeah. And then, luckily, the more open-hearted like you are, the stronger you are, actually, because the stronger the inner bliss and happiness you have. So you can bear to feel the feeling of the other. And then, similarly, also, you know, we have a way of seeing another the way we feel we are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, when you are in love, when you are feeling inner bliss, like you're so beloved and you love that beloved, when you see other people, they look more beautiful to you, and you sort of see the happiness side of them.
Mm-hmm.
Even they're kind of, and then you become like a good parent, or you become a good lover, and like your lover is like a little down, and you're kind of really good at cheering them up because you say, well, you're kind of down, but you know, I can see you grinning, and do you know what I mean? And you can tease them out of their moping because you begin to see that they have the potential in them of happiness, because every being does actually. And
so it's like even a responsibility to develop your own happiness.
That's the highest one.
In order to provide that for people.
And there is one form of Buddhist education, that doesn't want to oppress people into the non-duality vision, because it's too hard for people. They just see all the suffering and they think, how could this be nirvana? How could this be like bliss? You know,
the non-duality.
Too miserable. There's a bunch of people starving here or burning in a fire or whatever. This ridiculous. This could be. So they can't see that. So then to those people, there's a form of the education where you, okay, there's a place where you get free of it all. You let them do that. But and then what happens is they sort of don't get despaired by what they see and they try to open themselves more and they at least get themselves happy. But they don't get that happy because actually your own desire for happiness is not as strong as 100 people's desire for happiness. 100 people's desire for happiness, the more you open to it, gives you a much greater power. And because you want to, you know, it's like, you know, the marathon runner in ancient Greece who ran from Marathon where the Persians were coming, you know, Xerxes or somebody was, Canastali was coming, and then he wanted to save Athens and his, you know, his family and his friends and his patriots, compatriots. So he ran beyond the capability of his body and he gave the message, the Persians are coming, get ready, and then died because he actually broke his body because his love for his country was stronger than his, the ability of his body, you know, his mind was more powerful than his body. And then there's the famous story of the Japanese and why they were disqualified from world crew competition. You don't know that story?
No.
Well, there one time they got really close, and they do have big Japanese, and they got really close to beating the Cambridge crew shell, you know, the eight-man rowing thing, you know. And they were within like a foot of losing to them and in a big race, you know. And then as they floated over the line, two or three of the members of the eight crew dropped dead. They burst blood vessels in their head or something, you know. And so then they were disqualified because they're so gung-ho when they get together that they, again, they outdo the capacity of their body, you know, with their will to, for in that case, to win the race, you know. So the sort of the expansion of identification that the human being has and the ability to a person, to a parent with a child, you know, members of a family with each other, war buddies in a platoon, in a battle, you know, people on teammates in a soccer field, you know, then lovers, you know, during the honeymoon at least, they identify with each other. And, you know, this is special human ability. And so the Bodhisattva, who wants to be a Buddha, and then the Buddha, by definition, is a being that has expanded that identification limitlessly. Bodhisattva has expanded it tremendously, and then a Buddha limitlessly, which again gets into the area of like being almost inconceivable. And that gives them more courage and more strength and more energy to even be more happy themselves. Because then you say, okay, I love you. So what does that mean? In the Buddhist education, what I love you means is I want you to be happy. I have a will to your happiness. Mm. And then how could that have any meaning if you don't have some happiness yourself?
That's
have
key,
you had someone say, I love you and I'm totally miserable without you?
Sure.
And oh, you have, oh, good. Well, that must have been fun. But on the other hand,
it was like
semi-fun. Did you want to be supplying their happiness?
Or their misery, like, you know?
Well, no, because you, it's much more fun if someone who's really happy then initially wants to love you.
Sure.
And wants you to be happy.
Sure.
Right? So, in fact, that is how love, that's where the power of love comes, is from the happiness of the lover wanting the beloved to be as happy or more even, you know? And then from that increases infinitely, you know? Love being the strong force of the universe in Buddha's discovery is that. That's what his discovery is. His discovery really is nirvana, not that unenlightened people will suffer. It's that it's possible to be enlightened and have nirvana and live nirvana.
So what is that nirvana?
What is it? Freedom. It's nirvana is total freedom from suffering. And then is what is the minimalist way of saying, because Buddha was smart. If you go around promising people bliss, they think you're trying to sell them a drug or you're trying to con them or something because, you know, they think they know it's really, it's all miserable. And so initially he just said freedom from suffering. That was his minimalist thing. And later when it gets up into the esoteric things, like tantra and things like that, he says it's bliss, freedom, indivisible. Mm-hmm. That's what the nirvana is. And this is nirvana right here, supposedly.
Yeah, that's...
I don't quite have a full feeling for it yet, but I've sort of had a taste, and I think it is the case.
That's something to wrap your head around, right?
But,
it's like it's something to wrap your head around.
Yeah.
To say, well, this world that we're living in with everything that's going on, this actually is nirvana.
That's right.
But we have, like, we can't see it.
Well, that's because of ignorance, you see. If we the more we investigate it, we will find its reality. And then people, many, not just Buddha, but many people, millions of people went ahead of us and they did discover that reality. And they gave us all kinds of educational methods of how to do it.
Can you give me one example of how would you investigate that?
How?
Yes.
Well, just like anything, you would put it under analysis. You would analyze it. So what is it? Okay, here is me. I'm a miserable person. I feel dissatisfied all the time. I'm this and that. Oh, well, really? Is that really my fixed way of being? It's my habit of always wanting some more and always evaluating what I have and never being content with it. Okay, so therefore I wouldn't agree that this is bliss because I think bliss is something I have to get. I have moments of it, then I want more. Okay, so if I investigate that, I look at, well, who's really wanting that? Who am I? What am I? And then is this habit, am I stuck in this habit? And anything that you investigate, according to their scientific tradition and discovery, it will dissolve under your analysis. That is, nothing will, you know, they've anticipated the Copenhagen Declaration that you cannot pin down any point of substance in reality when you get to the super micro level, and there's no absolute objectivity. Because when you get to super micro level, then the act of observing it interferes with it. So actually the mind itself is a force within the nature. So mind itself will dissolve under analysis and you won't be able to find your mind. And any even atom or material object will dissolve under analysis, you won't be able to find your mind. And then one of the last things that you might think when you don't find the thing you're investigating is you might think that you found nothing.
Sure, yeah.
But actually nothing.
Or it's all like by worthless or, you know.
But by definition, that's just an expression that we say. And luckily we know the meaning of nothing, which is it's not there. So we didn't find it. We just didn't find what we were looking for. And actually, therefore we had a negational cognition. And a negational cognition has the nice quality about it that the mind then is open to experience something else. So for example, if you look for the elephant in this room, as we said the other day here,
yeah,
and you don't find it, then you never find the non-elephant. You just don't find the elephant. And then you're open to see the light and the person and the other things in the room. So you keep doing that. Everything you analyze, whatever it is, yourself especially. And then for example, when you don't find your fixed self, at first, you might have an experience like an existentialist nothingness experience, but then you, by reasoning, you know perfectly well that nothingness is not there. So you don't get stuck there, you know? That, you know, the emptiness of nothingness, for example, that's an expression, or the freedom of nothingness, or from nothingness, and from nothingness being a thing in itself. The ding an sich, you never find any ding an sich. Everything dings. Yeah. Every ding is just as interconnected with other dings. It's all interdinging.
Es gibt kein Ding an sich.
Interdinglichkeit, yeah. You find. Interdinglichkeit, that's it. You find. So the more you do that, the more free you realize you are, and you realize in a way you have a kind of choice. When you're going to be about to be miserable, you could decide to see the glass half full and not half empty, and you could decide to be a little more contented, and etc. You begin to have more inner freedom in your mind.
And seeing the glass half full or half empty, right? Yeah. This could be like a philosophical thing. It's like, oh, I'm an optimist. But it seems to me,
yes,
like under these circumstances, if you analyze and if you go in there, seeing the glass half full or half empty switches from being like a philosophical concept and it goes into being like an experiential,
of course,
like conviction, right?
Yes.
So
I don't use that word because that's the product of an inference. That's okay. An idea. A conviction is an idea from inference. It can start as a conviction, but then when it becomes experiential, it becomes something that you open to, you know, and you have it. But on the other hand, don't think that a philosophical thing is just nothing, because the conceptuality, although ultimately experienced, when we're really blown away, we have no concept temporarily, and when conceptuality returns, we sort of stop being blown away. But on the other hand, we aim to blow away through conceptuality. So conceptuality is extremely valuable for analysis. That's another thing that's been very misunderstood about Buddhism and has led to a lot of nonsense and a lot of cults, is that it's all simplified if you just don't think anything. Yeah. And all the meditation is about not thinking. And that's BS. And I don't mean Buddhist studies. And just not thinking will not necessarily help. It's a special kind of not thinking and special concept aimed by thinking. You know, they say, you know, there's two kinds of meditation categories in the Buddhist education system. There's one-pointed non-thinking meditation, mm-hmm. shamatha, and then there's analytic meditation, mm-hmm. vipassana. And there's another third kind, which yeah. is imagine visualizing meditation. That's more tantra, once you already realize emptiness or freedom. And of those two, the analytic one is more important, the conceptual one. And especially when it gets armed by one-pointedness, then when you get to the conclusion of the idea, for example, the idea that all things are relative because they are empty of any Dinge an sich Sichtigkeit.
Yeah.
And so you don't, that you come to, that's a concept, that's an obvious inference, but then you really press that on things and then it becomes an experience and you see through everything, you know, everything disappears. And yet you don't find, and even the state of it disappearing disappears. And then it's like the, then and then it's like the things that seem to come back are like reflections in a mirror. Mm. And the mirror surface is the surface of their freedom, their emptiness, their voidness, their Leerheit, right? Leerheit is what you say for emptiness, right? Leerheit.
So,
jawohl.
Jawohl. How do experiences that people have figure into this kind of thing? Because a lot of times you hear people would say, oh, I was somewhere and all of a sudden I felt this explosive thing and I felt one with the world and
that's
I was
great.
Super happy. And then like I sort of came out of it and now it's like, oh, I've experienced that and that's it. And how does that figure into this thing, like spontaneous experience?
The way that figures in is there's this like, that's called a space-like equipoise samadhi, which can come from the result of deep investigation and analysis combined with one-pointed focus on that. So going much more deep, you know, like, you know, the Rodin's thinker, you know, that sculpture?
Do you know that one? Yes.
We have one in front of the philosophy department at my university. And it's so obvious that he can't really think that well, because that posture is impossible to maintain. He's not a yogi. He's not sitting in a good posture, sitting straight in a balanced way.
He looks like he's breaking his head a little. Like,
to me, he looks constipated. He's worrying about his bowel movement, you know. And so that's a superficial, in a way. It's he's thinking, but he's not thinking where he's breaking through. You know, in order to be able to break through, you have to think more deeply and have a stronger focus. And I think many great philosophers did. Don't get me wrong. For example, Descartes, he did discover that when he looked for himself, he couldn't find it. Mm. That he actually did, which is that space type of experience. But he didn't have anybody to recognize that, you know.
Put it in a framework, sort of.
No, what he did was he made a little mistake. He was absolutely correct. He said, when I look for myself, I can't find it. But actually, it is myself that looks.
Yes.
So when I look, then I have a self. And then he thought that was an absolute thing. Yeah. But meanwhile, that is a relational thing, actually. So, you know, I think therefore I am. It's like an acceptance, a surrender to relationality. But he took it as a point of absolute certainty, which is not absolute, it's relative, right? He feels I'm here, you know. You know, if he had a Zen master, a good Zen master, not a nihilistic one who thinks you just don't think. If he had a good one, that Zen master would say, you're not sure that you're there. You're just saying that. So you're asserting it. That's okay. Then, and by asserting it, you're engaged in relativity and a way of being there. And that's fine. But don't make it into an absolute. You know, and that's what that guy would have whacked him on the head, right, with that paddle. You know, the way they do. But he did it. He was a yogi too. You know. Mm. You know. I don't know what posture he sat in. Maybe a comfortable chair. But he was a real yogi.
Not like this.
So many of the great. Kant was great. I love those people. Hegel, I have a problem with a little bit. This was so windbag, you know. But he was probably very good too. So yeah. So it's cool, you know. Really, Leerheit is the discovery that all relative things lack any non-relative element. And even the absolute itself lacks being something that is not the relative. Because although it is a concept as something that is not relative and therefore cannot relate to the relative, people propose all sorts of things as the absolute. They say God is absolute. They say nothingness is absolute, you know, because we have this craving because we are these language animals and we have a word for something relative and that always see things relating. And then we say, well, there's the opposite of that that's absolute and that must also refer to something. Mm. Or even like people think when they die, they're going to be nothing. They're going into nothing. But meanwhile, nothing is not a place. Nothing is not there to receive anybody. So nobody gets to stay there. The law of psychic thermodynamics, the mind is energy and it goes somewhere. And then where does it go? Then that's the thing people should know, because it's going to be them going somewhere.
That's, I think that's one of the one of the main things people, you know, when you talk about Buddhism with people, it's like, oh yeah, you know, it's like a philosophy. And it's like, no, it's not really a philosophy. You know what I mean? Oh, it's a religion. No, it's not really religion. And then people are like, oh yeah, I like mindfulness, right? I like basic meditation, which is great, right?
Yes.
Fantastic. Oh, great. But I think one of the points where it comes to like a big, ooh, I don't know, is this whole reincarnation business.
I know.
Which is kind of where you just approached.
Yes,
when
yes.
you said like by the law of thermodynamics, if the mind is energy, it can't just dissipate into whatever nothingness.
Well, you can have a little diffusion, but it doesn't get destroyed, is the thermodynamic thing. You know, you have entropy where it gets diffused and then sometimes comes back together, but it can't be destroyed. That's their theory. And that's based on observation, because guess what? Nobody's ever seen something become nothing. And also, this is most important. You know, the people get, oh, yeah, well, I like it in Buddhism, but I don't like this thing about reincarnation. They say, but on the other hand, and then when you mention something, they say, what's your evidence?
Mm.
You know, and I talk with my scientific colleagues all the time, and it took me many years to get out of the cultural mutual confirmation that everyone believes that, doesn't believe that, rather. And then you have to ask them just one question, because they're scientists. Who is it who discovered nothing? What's their evidence that nothing exists? What's evidence for that? And therefore, what's the evidence that they're going to go there? Because there's no there there. So you can't go there. And that, bam, the whole thing collapses. The minute you really focus on what nothing means, you can't be nothing. There is no such thing. That's what the word means. Mm. That relieved me after 40 years of debating with them about 10 years ago.
So what do they say to that?
They get mad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I asked them, like, did Carl Sagan show up, you know, at some scientific conference after he died and say, listen, it's cool, guys, I don't exist.
Yeah.
And all those religions are crazy, and everybody's crazy who's not accepting and embracing the nada, you know, like Miguel de Unamuno or Sartre or Camus. But that's the nada is kind of a nice thing, brave. It's like realizing selflessness or emptiness in a way. But, you know, Nagarjuna has a famous statement, the great Indian philosopher, Buddhist philosopher. He says, emptiness is the balm, the medicine for all kind of suffering and mental fixations and things. But if you fixate on emptiness, then therefore there's no cure for you. Do you know what I mean? Because it itself, because why? Because it's relativity is what it is. It's relationality. Emptiness means no non-relational thing that relevant. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Nothing is really not relevant because we can't go there because it isn't there, you know? And an absolute that was disconnected from relativity is irrelevant to anybody in relativity where we are, right?
So
therefore, the relativity is the absolute. So therefore, this is nirvana. And if we can press those two awarenesses together in the ultimate act of cognitive dissonance reconciliation.
Hello.
We're going to enjoy the relativity 100 times more. And we're going to be free of suffering. And we're going to help others to do that. And if we say we can't do that because it's inconceivable to press two opposite things together in the mind, then the great thing to work on is and analyze your own experience of your face in the mirror. When you look at your face in the mirror, you are seeing another person who looks just like Mike in a three-dimensional room that looks like your room, but left-right is reversed. And that's what you actually see. But without thinking, you correct it instantaneously, and you shave on the right side, which is on the left side in the mirror, and you shave on the
me
left
personally
side.
Not so much, but yeah, in general.
Yeah, with your beard, or you clip your beard. But the point is, in other words, that underlying awareness of that it's a mirror reflection, which is actually a correction, is instantaneously present with your illusory vision, which is that there's something through the mirror. Mm-hmm. And so you are holding two opposite things together, and you're having an improved perception of what you see.
Very true, yes.
And we are capable of that. So if we're capable of that, if we build on that, then we can realize this is nirvana while dealing with it as relativity. We can enjoy and experience and ameliorate relativity without losing track of it is nirvana. And then we find nirvana in every aspect of it. And then everything becomes enjoyable.
It seems like every time I it's not even that I think about it, but it seems like it's also something that has a lot to do with opening up something like a great creativity.
Oh, absolutely. Totally. I mean, I'm saying absolutely, right?
Yeah, the absolute.
But that's the thing. You see, the wisdom opens you up from any dogmatic conviction, any like fixation on any ideology or even on a theory. You know, modern science is the same as Buddhist science in that theory is always subject to revision by experience. You know, it's a hypothesis awaiting falsification or verification, depending. And so
this very much is not religion-like.
Yes, it's not religion. The great celebratory verse about the Buddha, Om ye dharma hetu prabhava hetun tisham tadagata hiyavadat tisham chayo nirodho evambadi mahasramaniye swaha. What that means is, of those things that arise from causes, the Buddha said, what are the causes, and also how they get to be ceased. And that was what he advocated. That such was the path that he advocated, the great wanderer, you could say, or the great seeker, Mahasramana. I actually like to translate it, the great vacationer, because he was
sounds
on
nice.
Vacation.
Yeah.
Forever, you know? So yeah, that's it. That's the thing. So, you know, the wrong way of teaching Buddhism is that somehow it's irrational, it's mystical, you throw away your reason, which is all the Westerners are more rational, which is not true, but they think they are. And that didn't help us, so we throw that away, and now we're going to meditate, and we're not going to think, and we're going to just experience without thinking. You know. And then what that leads to, and some gurus encourage that because they don't want those students to think that they're not getting anywhere and that the guru sucks, because they want like BMWs and they want to be served and they want a bunch of adulation from the students. So the less they think, the better. If they think after a month or two of this, like, what is this? Like, why am I doing this? You know, and I don't feel much better, you know? Mm. And then they'll look for more, you know?
Mm.
So that's the thing.
When it comes to guru or teacher, right?
Yes.
So many people will hear this, maybe, hopefully people will hear this and think, okay, I want to experience this. I want to explore. I want to, you know.
Good, that's good.
And
yes.
And a lot of people are then going to say, maybe, hopefully, I'm looking for someone to teach me this.
Yes,
this is going
right.
And you said something really nice. I hope you can say it again. About what, like, what qualifies for a good teacher, or like, how do you find a good teacher, like, or you know, a teacher, Lehrerin, right?
Yes.
Like, how do you find, like, what are the qualities to look for in someone, because there are so many people out there and there are so many labels and so many signs on the doorbell, like, oh, I teach this meditation and that one, and this is the truth, and this is the mystical this and that. Like, what, like, is there something you would recommend? Like, how would you find, or what are the qualities you would be looking for?
Well, you know, what do you look for when you seek an education? You know, You seek an education, say you want to be a chemist or you want to be a computer scientist. So you look for someone who's knowledgeable about computer science and you take that course. But you don't necessarily, if you come to a computer science teacher and that teacher says, only I know computer science and don't ever study with anybody else ever, and just reciting me, then you would be a little suspicious about that because there's a lot of faculties of computer science. So if you someone, well, but here you here's a book and here's this and here's a look and you try that, and that's great, you know. So I always give students a rule of thumb, which is if you meet people who are teaching something and you're learning from them and it seems to make sense to you and it seems when you try to put it into your mind and practice, it seems to open up some doors for you, then that's very good. And particularly if that person is happy to share with you what they know, And they also are perfectly happy when you go study some other thing. And so they're sort of relaxed about it. They don't seem to be too needy about you. But if you meet the one who says, ah, it's your karma, I'm your destined guru, one-stop shopping, everything here, don't go talk to anybody else, you might get confused, etc. Then that one you say, oh, thanks so much, that's so good, that's great, thanks a lot, goodbye. That's a rule of thumb that I give. And you know, the guru thing in Tibetan system has become very confused. There is an initiatory role for a lama or a guru in a special context, but it doesn't mean some sort of excessive dependence. But in a way, one is using that lama in the ceremonial way as a doorway to the Buddha, to the actual Buddha. You know, and it almost doesn't matter if the person is not perfect. And then when the person is in their civilian clothes, let's say, and they're driving down the street, if they say turn right down a one-way street, you can say, no, that's stupid. You know, you don't do something wrong from them. So someone should be ethical. They should walk their talk. They should not seem to be doing harmful. If there already is a group around someone, you look at the people in the group. If they seem very independent-minded and they have a friendly relation with the teacher, but they also have some respect because they learn something, but they're not real like slaves, you know. Like the Rigpa organization recently blew up, or there are plenty of them in Germany, I think, also.
Yes, yes.
And they all blew up because finally they got sick of that teacher exploiting them and behaving badly. And then that's especially bad because actually some of the things he taught were useful. Some were not. The excessive anti reason element is especially bad, an anti-learning element, and acting like you just empty your mind and stare at the guru. That's no good, that type. But still, some things that came through that person were useful. So they don't want to throw out whatever they lose of value because they dislike the bad things the person did, you know. But that's how you have to be more mature to be able to do that. They tend to turn against the whole thing when somebody abuses them. Like
that happens.
Yeah, right now.
Yes,
and that can be forestalled by people learning, and studying, and realizing this is like an educational process. You know, people don't go to study chemistry or become a computer scientist by some guy on the faculty who says, "Oh, you don't have to take 101 and 201 and 301 and then advanced seminar. Just come to advanced seminar and just look at me in the seminar, and you'll be perfect computer scientist." Nobody would think that was the case. That's ridiculous. And yet that's the way they behave, those guys. You just depend on the lama, you don't have to learn anything. And I've known people who have depended on some lama for 30 years, and they still don't know anything.
Yeah.
So that's really an abuse.
Maybe that's because that whole thing still has a veil of mystery.
That's right.
It's like, oh, the meditation and the secret
techniques, yes,
and so on, you know?
Yes.
Do you think do you think it's necessary to sort of get rid of that veil, get rid of that thing?
Or? Yeah. To get rid of it ahead of time and find out what's going on as much as possible. Like, especially when people first hear about it, they get excited and they say, I need a teacher. Then you say, that's a mistake. If you need a teacher, you probably don't need a teacher. What you do is need to learn more. And then when you've learned a lot and you have a way of evaluating different possible teachers, and there are some exceptional cases, like I did meet my teacher, just I immediately knew that was, I was terrified in a way, I was completely drawn. And then that person immediately taught me a bunch of stuff. And he said, he's not my guru. Mm. He's just going to teach me a language. You know, he always stepped out of the domination game. You know, and the Dalai Lama does that. He's so great in that sense. You know, he can give a ritual, and he's very majestic with his gestures, and, you know, recites a mantra. And then he's out there chuckling and cracking a dirty joke or whatever, and shaking hands and being perfectly normal, and nobody has to blow a horn or act like it's some big deal with him. And then when he goes to a hotel or something, he's visiting somewhere to teach, he goes and meets all the dishwashers and stuff. And it's just as nice to them as he is to the whatever. Yeah. Goes to the White House, he digs the security guy. And when he went to the Bush Senior house in New York, I mean in Washington, Millie the dog ran away with him. Because they were paranoid about the Chinese, so they didn't let him go out the front door. So he went out a little back elevator from the kitchen, and they didn't notice that the dog got in the elevator with him. And then the dog was running across the lawn because they didn't want the photograph of him leaving the White House to show the Chinese, so they wouldn't be mad. Bush Senior was a big, you know, thing about the Chinese. And so they had the Secret Service guys were running to try to catch the dog. The dog wanted to go see Dalai Lama. Dalai Lama's not going to pick her up by the ears. Millie, her name is Millie the dog.
When did you first meet the Dalai Lama?
1964.
Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
Well, my old Mongolian teacher, who was my first teacher, took me to India to meet him.
Oh.
After studying about a year and three quarters with him, almost 2 years, because I kept bugging him to make me a monk, and he refused. And he said, "I know you're sincere. You want to be a monk. You think that's all you want to do with your life is study this stuff and meditate on it, and that you want to be a monk. But it's not your karma to be a monk." I think he knew about my soulmate was there waiting, which I didn't know about. I had actually been already married quite young. I married very young. Mm. And I, you know, already, I was like fantasizing. I'm like Shakyamuni. I'm leaving the wife and child to go get a life and nonsense thing. So, but he knew I was, you know, there was no monastery for me in America. There was no monastery in the 60s. Mm. You know, still isn't really much Buddhist monasteries there. And, you know, there's Zen centers and meditation centers, but not really actual monasteries. So anyway, so that's it. So listen, you know what? I love talking to your people, I guess in Berlin and wherever it is, or maybe all over the world from Berlin. And my one thing my teacher told me when I graduated and got my PhD in 1972, I visited him among a bunch of other things he told me, giving me many jobs. He said, "By the way, what did you study there?" And I said, "Well, this and that, and the other, Japanese, Mongolian, Sanskrit, Chinese." And so, and then he says, looks and says, "You didn't study Russian?" I says, "No, I didn't study Russian. You didn't tell me to study Russian." And he is from Russia. He's a colleague from Russia. And he used to say bad things about the white Russians, actually, because they were like Indians on a reservation or something. And Stalin was really nasty to them during the war, you know, the Kalmyk Mongolian. And so, "You didn't tell me to study Russian." I said, "Oh, that's terrible." He said, "Okay, well, at least you're fluent in German, right?" I said, No, I didn't learn German. I said, I had to pass a test in some academic German group. I didn't learn to speak. Come on, you know. He says, "Oh," he says, "when you're an old man, if you can't teach the Dharma in Russian and German, your work will not be finished and you will not be happy." I can still hear him say that.
What a setup.
All this time. I go do lecture in Russia frequently. Yeah. And I can't speak Russian. I tried a couple of times to study and then I didn't have time. And it's a difficult language. Yeah. Very similar to Sanskrit in some respects, actually. Quite interesting. And then I haven't visited German much, although my guru, my better half, my woman guru, she's half German, but she doesn't teach me. she's Westphalia, you know, from Westphalia. Her father was.
So am I from Westphalia. Yeah.
You're from Westphalia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. We don't know where von Schleberger is. Where Schleberger is. That's what the father's name was, von Schleberger.
Okay.
But we don't know. There's some castle on a symbol, you know, like a family arm. We don't know where it is. We never went there.
I'm sorry.
And he died in Köln. You
know, okay.
Which is there, right?
Yes.
So anyway, I like that. So we can do more podcasts. I can do you a podcast also. I will interview you. on Skype or on Zoom or something, okay?
I would love that.
Yeah. I like to do that. Totally. I have a podcast, lots of them.
You,
hundreds of them.
I know that.
Okay.
You know, this is true. I'm not saying this to put like honey on your honey on your belly or something. But
no.
When people ask me, it's like, okay, so we like your podcast. Like, what should we do if we want to learn more about Buddhism? Literally, always the first thing I say is listen to the Bob Thurman podcast.
Wonderful.
So,
okay, well, you got it. But you honor. Have your own art, and you have your own special knowledge, and you found your way here. And so I want to do a podcast with you in the future. I'll do more with you if you want. You know, if you
I would
some
love
set
to.
Of question.
Yes, beautiful.
On Skype, you know, from Woodstock, I'll do it.
Perfect.
I love
thank
it.
You.
I love it.
Thank you very much for the
okay,
time.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, really. Mike.
Wenn dich die Themen aus diesem Podcast interessieren, dann lade ich dich dazu ein, in mein Buch reinzulesen. Es heißt, stell dir vor, du wachst auf. Die 4O+X-Methode für mehr Präsenz und Klarheit im Leben und ist erhältlich als broschiertes Buch, als E-Book und als Hörbuch. Wenn du dich über die Themen in diesem Podcast weiter austauschen möchtest, dann lade ich dich dazu ein, in unsere Facebook-Gruppe zu kommen. Du findest sie bei Facebook unter Stell dir vor, du wachst auf, genau wie der Titel meines Buchs, oder auch unter 4O+X, also viermal der Buchstabe O und dann plus X. Das ist der Name der Methode, die ich in dem Buch vorstelle. Wenn du mir Feedback geben möchtest, erreichst du mich bei Facebook/CursedOfficial, bei Instagram @CursedZeit oder über die E-Mail-Adresse coaching@cursed.de. Vielen Dank und bis zum nächsten Mal.